You're listening to an SBS News podcast.
You know, it's a tedious campaign when you start counting the petrol station visits.
Hi, I'm Rania Yallop.
And I'm Elfie Scott.
And welcome to Party Time, the podcast from SBS News where we'll keep you up to date on everything you need to know for this federal election.
Okay, we are officially on the home stretch of this campaign. There is just over 1 week to go until the big day.
Yeah, we're really counting down the days now. Is there anything interesting that caught your eye this week, Elfie?
To be totally honest, no, not really. Like, this feels like it's been a very sterile campaign. And I think for a lot of people, it kind of feels like Groundhog Day. So nothing, is it terrible to say that nothing is really jumping out at me?
Yeah, I think that's kind of fair. I think especially those journalists that are like out there on that campaign trail at the moment. By my count, Peter Dutton has now visited 13 petrol stations in 4 weeks as he tries to spruik his policy to cut the fuel excise.
You know, it's a tedious campaign when you start counting the petrol station visits.
Yep. And talking about transport, pre-polling is opened and there's been a bit of an accident. A Liberal Party campaign truck crashed into the Quakers Hill Community Centre in Sydney.
Yeah, to be clear, no one was hurt. It did a little damage outside the building. And there's a video that then seems to show someone stripping the campaign branding, which has the Liberal candidate Rattenberg's name and picture off the truck.
Yeah, the statement from the New South Wales Liberal Party didn't address that stripping the picture off the truck thing, but they did say that a truck delivering materials to the community hall dislodged a portico and that they regret any inconvenience that it's caused.
The AEC says the booth has now officially reopened.
Yeah. Petrol stations and minor truck accidents. This election cycle is really delivering.
Okay. So this week, it's all about cost of living. Rania and I have decided to tackle the topic of topics.
Yeah. The number one issue on the list of voter concerns, talking about all of those expenses that you like look at and like make you groan a little bit, like all of that really unexciting stuff, food, housing, all of those expenses that it just costs to like live your life.
And we're going to be talking about what the major political parties are offering to relieve some of those pressures.
So joining us is Saul Eslake. He's an independent economist. Firstly, thank you so much for joining us today, Saul.
That's a pleasure, Rani. I'm looking forward to the conversation. Yeah,
just to start off with, like, what do we mean when we talk about cost of living and how did we get into this like cost of living crisis in the first place?
Well, like, cost of living ordinarily refers to the expenses that people incur every day, every week, every month to support themselves and, if they have one, their family. So it's a pretty broad-ranging concept. Officially, changes in the cost of living are measured by what the Australian Statistics Bureau calls the Consumer Price Index, which is an average of more than 90 different categories of prices weighted in accordance with people's spending patterns. So, for example, housing is the biggest single element of the Consumer Price Index. Food and beverages are a fairly large component, whereas, you know, the cost of international travel is a relatively small component. But because, however you measure it, inflation has been considerably higher over the last 3 years than it had been on average over the previous 25 years, you know, people have been talking about a cost of living crisis. Now, I'm old enough to remember in the early 1980s when inflation was typically over 10% per annum. And in Australia, that continued until the early 1990s, you know, in some ways echoing that phrase in Paul Hogan's Crocodile Dundee. You know, that's a cost of living crisis when prices are going up more than 10% per annum, whereas in the last couple of years, the most they went up in a single 12-month period was a little over 7%. But nonetheless, for people who are under, say, 35 years old, 7% inflation is the highest that they're able to remember. So it's not surprising that people have talked about it in terms of a crisis.
Yeah. So, like, is it anyone's fault that we got into this in the first place?
Well, yes. Yeah, it is. I mean, inflation is typically the result either of some external shock over which the policymakers of an individual nation like Australia have no control, or it can be the result of failed or misguided economic policy. One, of course, is the impact that Russia's invasion of Ukraine in February 2022 had on the prices of things of which Russia and Ukraine are significant producers. So coal, oil, gas, some grain products like wheat and barley, and although it wasn't immediately obvious at the time, some things like phosphate and neon, of which Ukraine was a significant producer, all saw significant surges in prices in the aftermath of Putin's invasion of Ukraine. Another factor was the significant disruptions to a range of global supply chains, motor vehicles, electronics, consumer electronics, ranging everything from flat screen TVs to iPhones, a range of health products, pharmaceuticals in some cases, that were attributable to COVID or lockdowns caused by COVID. Then there are also policy failures. Inflation historically often results from, as Milton Friedman famously said, too much money chasing too few goods and services. Putting that in a modern context, with the benefit of hindsight, the stimulatory measures that governments and central banks put in place at the beginning of COVID to offset the damage that the lockdowns were going to cause were kept in place too long. In Australia in particular, interest rates were held at record lows until May of 2022. So when you have monetary policy stimulus, as it was called, that is record low interest rates, allowing people to borrow more money than they otherwise would be able to do, that results in demand for a range of goods exceeding the supply of those goods. You get increases in prices. And then more broadly, I think policy failures contributed directly to the rapid inflation in housing costs that we've seen.
Can we also talk a little bit about voter priorities? I just want to get a quick sense of like where cost of living sits as a priority in this election, and if it's really the thing that's going to decide this election, because that seems to be what everybody is saying, but do you think that's true?
Well, the opinion polls certainly say that it has been the major priority of voters since really the cost of living started accelerating in 2022. Something like 72-73% of voters have consistently nominated the cost of living as their top priority, as their major concern. And the same poll has said that the second major priority for voters, with about 38% of them consistently nominating them, has been housing, which, as we've just been discussing, is the biggest single element of the cost of living concern. So put those two together and by a country mile.
Yeah. So on some of those like specific reliefs, not the kind of structural stuff yet, but just what the parties are really offering people is not as a bribe, but a little bit as a bribe for their vote. Tax-wise, you've got the coalition with this like one-off $1,200 payment. Labor's looking at an instant $1,000 tax deduction. What's the difference between those two policies?
Well, let me just go back for a minute and talk a little bit about the policies that have been put in place during the cost of living crisis. The most obvious ones are the electricity bill rebates that the government has provided, which the coalition has supported some but opposed others. It's understandable that governments would want to give some relief to households from the very substantial increase in energy bills because, electricity and gas is an essential service. What I and other economists have been a bit critical about is that the last two rounds of that relief have been completely untargeted. The first round of energy bill relief was targeted at pensioners and people on social security cards, people who clearly can't afford sudden large increases in the cost of an essential item like electricity. But the more recent ones were completely untargeted. And, to illustrate that point, for historical reasons, I have 2 meters on. So I got 2 rounds of rebates every time. I shouldn't be getting one because although I don't like having to pay higher prices for electricity, I can afford to do it. I shouldn't be getting relief from higher electricity bills at the expense of people who earn a lot less than I do. And I certainly shouldn't be getting 2 of them. So, I'm critical not of the idea of governments offering people help with something like electricity bills, but it could have been better targeted and better administered than I think it has been. And since the government is offering another round of those electricity bill reliefs, at least for the second half of this year, if they're re-elected. Well, you know, I'm critical of that. The opposition, as you said, is offering a 50% cut in petrol excise for 12 months that will expire if they win the election in at the beginning of July 2026. Now, as it happens, people are getting that relief anyway because the price of crude oil has dropped from over $80 a barrel to about $65 a barrel during the election campaign, largely because as a result of the madness emanating from Washington, people are expecting a recession in the United States and possibly in the world, which we know will result in lower demand for crude oil. And as it happens, some of the world's biggest oil producers are also now belatedly talking about increasing oil production. So in a sense, the relief the coalition is offering isn't really necessary. It is obviously targeted at people who drive a lot and at people who drive more less fuel-efficient vehicles who tend to be concentrated in the seats that the coalition is supposedly targeting in the outer suburbs of our big cities in rural and regional areas. The other thing they're offering is the so-called Lamington, the low and middle income tax offset, which was a feature of the Morrison government's rounds of tax cuts in the late 2010s, which were continued during COVID, but then abandoned by Labor when they first came to office. That provides a payment of about $1,250 to a broad range of taxpayers with incomes of between about $50,000 and I think it's $120,000 or $130,000. But it's not payable until you've filed your tax return, which most people do in July or August of each year. So that payment of about $1,250 won't reach anyone until July next year, by which time the Reserve Bank is telling us inflation will be back to about 2.5%, in which case, you know, people shouldn't really be needing relief from cost of living pressures. I mean, for that matter, Labor's proposed two reductions in the bottom tax rate of 1 percentage point, they don't come in until July 26 and July 27, respectively, by which time, as I say, the Reserve Bank and the Treasury are telling us that the cost of living pressures that we've been experiencing over the last 3 years will have gone away. So bearing in mind that the budget is also telling us that we're looking at budget deficits for 10 years out to 2035, 36. You kind of wonder why governments are offering cost of living relief for a period 12 months out from here when both the Reserve Bank and the Treasury are telling us the cost of living problem will have gone away.
Can I ask just a very quick, possibly quite dumb question off the back of that? do budget deficits matter? Like, yes or no?
It depends how big they are and the position you're starting from. Most economists, at least since the theories of Maynard Keynes in the 1930s, have accepted that it's appropriate for governments to run deficits to try and ameliorate recessions and economic downturns. But the quid pro quo from that has always been that they should be running surpluses when the economy is doing well, so that, or at least running balanced budgets, so that you do have the capacity to respond effectively and forcefully when you're confronted with a major downturn. And we haven't been doing that.
Just looking at housing as well, is there anything different? You know, it's a different approach from Labor and the coalition this time. One is, you know, super deposit and being able to claim mortgage payments against tax. Labor's offering just a 5% deposit for everyone. Will either of those actually make it easier to buy a home?
Only for those people who are able to arrange their affairs to take advantages of the scheme. And that's a small minority of those who would like to own their homes. What both policies will do, although I argue the coalitions will do more of it than Labor's, will be to allow people to spend more on housing than they'd be able to, by allowing them to borrow more than they would be able to. And we have 60 years of evidence, 60 years of history that unambiguously and unequivocally demonstrates that anything that allows Australians to spend more on housing than they'd otherwise be able to, be it first home owner grants, stamp duty concessions, mortgage deposit guarantee schemes, shared equity schemes, tax breaks for property investors, lower interest rates, or easier credit conditions by banks. Anything that allows Australians to spend more on housing than they otherwise would results in more expensive housing and a smaller proportion of people owning that housing. And, you know, the thing is, despite billions of dollars being spent on schemes like that, The home ownership rate has been declining steadily since the first of them was introduced. Home ownership rates among people under the age of 45 have fallen back to their lowest since the first post-war censuses in 1947 and 1954. And the home ownership rate among people aged between 45 and 54, who are not exactly young, right, that's down to below where it was at the census of 1961. So these policies that have at their heart allowing people to spend more on housing than they'd be able to otherwise have been a complete and abject failure. And yet policymakers on both sides of the political divide keep doing the same thing. You know, it kind of reminds you of Albert Einstein's definition of insanity, that he's doing the same thing over and over again and expecting a different result next time. And you sort of ask yourself, why? And it's hard to avoid the answer, despite this sounding very cynical, that for all the crocodile tears that politicians on both sides of the divide shed for the difficulties faced by aspiring young homebuyers, the reality that the politicians know is that there's only 110,000 of them on average each year. And even if you assume that everyone who succeeds, there's five or six who don't, that's at most 750,000 votes for policies that would restrain the rate of house price inflation or stop it altogether. Whereas the politicians also know that at any point in time, there are 11 million or more Australians who own their own home. There are 2.25 million Australians who own at least one investment property. So there's maybe 12.5 million votes for policies that would keep house prices rising, preferably at a faster rate than incomes or average earnings. So, you know, on the one hand, 750,000 votes, on the other, 12.5 million. Even the dumbest of our politicians can do that math. And although they would never admit it, they do it every time there's an election and in between elections as well.
Saul, that is incredibly depressing maths. Thank you so much for drawing out those numbers for us.
I'm sorry. I mean, in 45 years of trying to understand why governments and politicians do what they do, and maybe to predict what they will do, I've never found that cynicism about their motives has been a cause of error. You know, I've been wrong for other reasons, but not usually for being misguided as to why they do what they do.
I mean, the coalition is going hard on migration as the solution to easing the cost of housing. Mm-hmm. Will that work? Like, will reducing migration actually help?
Well, let me say one small thing about migration and then turn to it in a bigger context. It's interesting that both major parties have agreed that banning foreign investors from buying established properties for 2 years will help homebuyers. Now, that's because they argue that homebuyers who, or aspiring homebuyers who get outbid by foreign investors with lots of money buying established homes, you know, that's somehow unfair. And I don't disagree with them about that. But the point is that there are fewer than 1,500 foreign investors who buy established properties each year. It's undeniable that immigration adds to the demand for housing. And for any given supply of housing, the more immigrants you have, the greater the demand for housing will be. And in the first instance, that usually finds itself putting upward pressure on rents, because almost all migrants, when they come to Australia, start out by renting. So initially, that does put upward pressure on rents, and subsequently, it can put upward pressure on house prices, depending on how many houses that are being built. But to look at only that aspect of immigration is to miss a much bigger picture, which is, of course, that immigrants also add to supply, you know, not just of tradies and construction workers, although some of them do directly do that, but they also add to the supply of other goods and services that the Australians who are here already regard as essential to their ways of life. So you think about the number of immigrants who are working in occupations ranging from aged and childcare and fruit picking at the low paid end of the spectrum to doctors, accountants, investment bankers, and those sorts of things at the high end of the spectrum with a lot in between. So the evidence that we have is that immigration adds more to overall supply than it does to overall demand of the broad range of goods and services, typically because most immigrants who come to Australia have been educated. So, yes, if you cut back immigration, it would reduce the demand for housing and thus, in the first instance, reduce some of the upward pressure on housing, but it would have other costs that, in my view, outweigh the whatever benefit might arise from cutting immigration in the first place.
Interesting. And just finally, Saul, on all of this, like, who's managing the economy better? Who has a better plan overall? And, like, why should we care about that? To me, it kind of feels like the government can just keep on piling up debt. Like, that's not really my problem. If stuff's coming my way, does it really matter?
Well, Rania, you're younger than me, so in a sense it actually does matter to you more than me, even if you don't perceive this at the moment, because, well, for two reasons. One, because although government debt doesn't affect you directly, the government has to pay interest on that debt, and money that's spent on interest is money that can't be spent on other things that you might value more, such as, you know, education, health. If you have a disability on the NDIS, or if you're one of a growing number of people who are more worried about our security, given that we can no longer rely on the United States as a trusted ally, as we have done since the end of World War II, it's harder to spend more on defence without either collecting more tax or cutting spending in some other areas. The other thing is that in the absence of any coherent policies to reduce the deficit, what happens by default is what economists and others call fiscal drag or bracket creep. That is, over time, people get pushed into higher tax brackets as a result of their wages going up, even if prices are going up faster than their wages. And that's been a source, that's been one of the reasons why the government has been able to run two budget surpluses in the past 2 years. Fiscal drag, that is pushing people up into higher tax brackets over time, even if their real incomes aren't rising, disproportionately falls on younger people who get most of their income from wages and salaries. And wages and salaries are taxed at full marginal rates, whereas older people's income typically comes from things like dividends and capital gains, rents, payments out of trusts, and payments out of superannuation funds, all of which are taxed at lower rates than the tax that's applied to wages and salaries. So, you know, continually running deficits and over time eliminating them by fiscal drag is a form of intergenerational inequity, that is, between older and younger generations, that's just as bad as the intergenerational inequity that's built up because of the way the housing boom has been, you know, managed or mismanaged by governments of both political persuasions over a very long time. So, you know, I would argue that even if they're not directly affected by poor budgetary management at the moment, you know, people ought to think about it. You know, if they're young people, what will happen over the rest of their lives? If they're older people, what will happen to their kids and grandchildren's lives if they have them?
Yeah, wow. Thank you so much for that explanation. I guess this is way more expansive than even I gave it credit for. So that was really, really helpful. Thank you so much, Saul, for walking us through all of that.
That's a pleasure.
I feel like I honestly learnt so much in that chat. Like, Saul's analysis of the contribution of migrants compared to the extra weight they put on housing is so interesting. I also feel like there were just a few really solid reasons for young people to feel even more upset in there.
Yeah, if you weren't angry before. Before we wrap up this week, I thought we'd have a look at early voting, because the Australian Electoral Commission announced that over 500,000 Australians cast their vote early on the first day of pre-polling. They're expecting around half of all voters will cast their vote early in this voting period.
Wait, Rania, what are the legitimate reasons that people can vote early?
Yeah, so it can be distance from polling booths, that you have to travel, that you've got work, that you're going to be sick, that you're caring, that sort of thing.
Okay, right. So you can't just vote early because you can't be bothered to turn up on voting day.
Yeah, not really, although, you know, you don't have to provide proof when you're doing this as well. You just need to be able to give a reason.
Okay, that is key.
And there's heaps of polling centres that are around if this is something you do need operating in the lead up to the election. On the AEC website, there's a list of all of them, along with operating hours, accessibility ratings for each venue, etc. It's worth noting that there's like a lot of public holidays that have happened during this period. So it's a bit busier. You know, we didn't have that first weekend that we'd usually have through Easter, Anzac Day, it's closed, and also some of that weekend too.
Awesome. Thank you. That is super useful. But also we should note that I think if you vote early, you're likely missing out on a key sausage sizzle opportunity, aren't you?
Yes, which is devastating. Although there's like no rule against if you're like outside of your electorate to just go to the sausage sizzle on the day. You know, you can just pop past. There's no obligation to vote first.
That's a very good point. Also, you could just make a sausage at home. Let's be fair. Okay, that is it for this week. Thank you so much for listening. To keep up with all our election coverage, head to the SBS News website.
Yeah, and we'll see you next week when we'll be talking about the winners and the losers of the election promises that we've seen so far.
Who's getting the most attention and who is seriously missing out from the conversation so far. But before then, please subscribe, leave us a 5-star review, and we will catch you on the flip side.
See you then.
Bye.